Okay, well, thank you. It's always strange when the organizers invite each other. I don't know what it means exactly, but the other organizers wanted me to try predict where the subject will go, and I'm not that foolish yet. So I agreed to maybe try explain, sort of take stock on one point, which is what I want to do today, sort of see where we're at. Probably in a few weeks I'll already be out of date, but let me try to do this at this point. I think the part of the subject that has really flourished is the predictive power. I mean, it's clear that random matrix theory is really an essential part in formulating conjectures for us. The ones that are checked numerically are very convincing, so I don't think there's any doubt about leading terms in various conjectures. And so that part is developed. Now, I don't think there's any more to comment other than that that should be completed, and it's beautiful. As the physicist would say, we have our standard model now. But this is a subject which is not just an experimental science, even though that's one of the beauties of it. It's also, when you talk about the zeta functions, you've got to prove something too. And that's tough. So I want to describe the part of the subject which in which there is a lot of progress with applications. I'm not going to give the applications. They are influenced by various features which enter in random matrix theory. And the other thing I want to do is, if there is any hope to really bust this subject open ever, I am convinced it has to come from higher dimensions. And for that point of view, it is crucial to think about these things in general and formulate them in general and understand them in general. And there's one problem which I'm really quite optimistic will be solved before long. And that's the subconvexity problem in general. So I want to just remind you what L functions are. Those who were here 2 weeks ago gave an overview. The first board will be the same, but luckily I will then get into details of what I introduced there. All right, so we've seen elliptic curve L functions, Dirichlet L functions, Riemann zeta function. The context in which all these L functions live is the group G, GLM. And we'll work out here over the rationals, though some of the main technical problems I will mention, there are technical problems in going to a number field, and they indicate that we have to change our strategies seriously along the way. So an L function is formed out of a automorphic cusp form, which can be defined classically or in a modern language. What it amounts to in the end is some representation, cuspidal representation, which is periodic, and I'm not going to go through that theory here. We'll never get anywhere. What it produces for you is something which is a let me just describe what it is. It's a tensor product of representations, one for each prime. This is the context in which our subject takes place, so we better learn it. Yeah, FP is a representation of GLN QP, N by N matrices with periodic entries. So GLNR is where you're all familiar with, or is what you're all familiar with at least. It's automorphic, so it's got some properties under GLNQ. That's what automorphic means. And the important thing is if we have an automorphic cusp form, which I'll denote by F, we can form an L function. This is part of the subject that's well understood. These are the L functions that we know and we want to work with, and it's a conjecture or philosophy that these are all of them. So an L function comes by making a product over all primes and the infinite prime, in this case of the rational numbers. And at each prime, this local representation, which is a representation of GLNQP or GLNR, gives me a local factor, LSFP, which I'm going to describe at least vaguely now, an Archimedean factor. And then the global L function, LSF, and this, the people in automorphic forms would never call the L function, but given that the size of a function is everything, not just its vanishing, we make this very important distinction between the finite part and the infinite part. The product of all primes of the local factors, which I'll tell you about in a second, and then a global L function following Riemann, which is LSF infinity times LL So our comedian part is actually put separately in forming the global L function. If you look at Corvallis lectures on automorphic forms, this thing will be called L, by the way. All right, these LSFPs are easiest to describe when FP is unramified. And I'm going through this for a reason. So this is some kind of representation of GLN QP, which has got a vector invariant under GLN ZP. Those are at almost all primes, it's unramified. And in that case, the representation is parameterized. This is due to Sataki. I'll use a variant of Langlands here. This is parameterized by a diagonal matrix, alpha 1 FP to alpha n FP, n complex numbers, a diagonal semi-simple matrix, in fact, a semi-simple conjugacy class, in the complex group GLNC, which, for those of you who want to know, this is the connected component of the Langlands group here. That's the parameterization of a local representation that comes out of the global automorphic form at each place P, and if it's unramified, you can parameterize it by these numbers in what are called Sataki parameters. And then you can form the local factor out of these numbers. These are these mysterious numbers that appear in each local factor, LSFP. It's a determinant of the identity. Now I'll call this whole matrix. It's just alpha FP. Its order is not important, so think of it as a semi-simple conjugacy class. Det P to the minus S to minus 1, like with the Riemann zeta function. And this will be something which is degree n in P to the minus S, indicating that we come from an automorphic form on GLN. All right, you form this almost all places. You do it actually, it can be done at all places, including the Archimedean place. You then append this factor here. And whatever was known to Riemann is known here. That is the analytic continuation and functional equation for any automorphic form, cusp form. And that's work of Godma and Jacquet. They form the so-called standard L function, but since I'll need more than that, I'll even form a little more fancy thing in a second. So that's the standard L function, LSF, and the important thing is lambda S F, the completed L function, is entire. So this is the part of the subject that's well understood. It's got a functional equation, lambda S, or maybe 1 minus S, F tilde. There's F goes to F tilde. That's the contragradient representation, which is basically like chi bar in the Dirichlet character, the complex conjugate. There's a sign of the functional equation that you've all seen in one form or another in examples, which is a Gauss sum, and its modulus is 1. There's a conductor, which appears to this factor, lambda S F. So that's the functional equation, takes F to F bar, S into 1 minus S. There's a sign, and there's this very important number, the conductor. NF is an integer. It's a product of powers of primes at which what I was describing doesn't happen, at which you ramified. And it's the standard conductor of the standard L function, and it's an important number. As I said in my lecture 2 weeks ago, it measures how complex F is. All right, those are the L functions. But in order to give this lecture, I need fancier ones. So more generally, this was an insight of Langlands. If you take this group GLNC in this example, and you take a finite dimensional representation of this Langlands dual into a finite dimensional vector space, say it's an irreducible representation, complex representation of a complex group, then you can form LSF rho. So there's not just the standard L function, there's a whole slew of L functions that are associated just with one automorphic form, corresponding to all the representations of this Langlands dual group. And this is formed the same way, except in the local factor, LSF P rho. Instead of taking the determinant of the standard representation, you have to take a much bigger space, depending on the dimension of W here, or V, whatever I'm calling it. That's always identity minus rho of alpha of F. which is now an element in this vector space, P to the minus S always to the minus 1. That's a local thing. At the Archimedean place, there's a similar definition. And you piece them together, and then you don't know if these things are all analytic with functional equations. But many cases of this are known, and those are the cases that are driving the subject right now, which is why I introduced them. It is a conjecture that all of these should have meromorphic continuations with known poles. That before we start to examine the zeros, we need to understand maybe the pole. So in Booker's talk, he was talking about the RT and L functions. They fall into this category. But I didn't build the Galois group into this picture, but that is an easy thing to do. All right, so that's that. And then there's one more. And it's a little more complicated. But it has a classical origin to well-known people in our subject, Rankine and Selbo. Not a joint paper. Most of you could get it. I didn't know Rankine, but knowing Selberg, that's not a surprise. Okay. So this was discovered by them in the simplest case separately. And I will formulate the most general version of this. So suppose, and I'll just do three. We'll be using this with two and three. Suppose I have F1, F2, and F3. But you could have 17 of them. And you want to form LSF, F1 times F2 times F3. The Rankine-Selberg, the real Rankine-Selberg is about F1 and F2, and both of these are classical forms in the upper half plane, but I'm going to take three and form it in general, and from that picture you'll see the general definition. So I just have to give you the local definition. And certainly, in general, this is not known to have the analytic properties. The Fs are the ones I started off with always. LS... this is a bad notation. Let me take F double prime, F triple prime. Sorry, what?
This is on GL2.
No. I'm forming the 317 on any GLM. Once I'm making a definition locally, it's no problem.
The FI are a different GLM?
They could be different. They could be the same. There could be any number of them. And at an unramified place... This would be the determinant of I minus the tensor. Well, I'm just taking the standard thing here. Alpha primed FP. What was my notation? I can't remember anymore. Alpha F primed tensor alpha P F double prime tensor alpha P F. These are the semi-simple conjugacy classes. This is well defined. Once I make a determinant, P to the minus S to the minus 1. So if you have just two factors, this is this Rankine-Selberg, and it's understood in GLM completely after lots of works, but most notably Jacquet, Schleich, and Piotrowski-Shapiro. The complete analytic properties were not quite there, especially when Zove and I needed to use it. Found the subject had slight holes in it, which only becomes apparent when you try to use it. It's now complete due to Waltz-Berger and Moglas. And Shahidi. Okay. So the product of two of them, the analytic properties in the nature of a nature similar to this, is well understood. And so you know the analytic continuation functional equation, the conductor, the sign of the functional equation, etc. The case of three is a special thing due to Paul Garrett, and it's known only, well, at least as far as I know, I'm not quite up to date on all the subtleties, but the case that's interesting to me here is the case of three forms on GL2, which will play a big role in this lecture. And that is understood first due to the work of Garrett, who was the first insight. All right, so those are our beasts. That's the context in which we want to understand the basic problems that random matrix theory, for which random matrix theory predicts the answer. Let me just add one more thing about this conductor, since it's an important thing. There's something I'll call the analytic conductor. And that's because a lot of us are analysts, and we like to vary the Archimedean place. And if you do that, you will not just pick it up the features by varying that NF. So there was NF, which was the conductor, which is a product of the ramified places to appropriate powers, the integer in the functional equation, the analog of Q for a Dirichlet-L function. However, in general, I might vary zeta along the line, the half line, then T is playing the role of Q. Or I might be varying automorphic representations at the Archimedean place, holomorphic, maybe varying the weight in GL2, or what are called mass forms, varying the eigenvalue. So for that purpose, you need to put in a factor here, which you might call NF infinity. So this is an Archimedean piece. Which in a paper of mine and Ivanich, where we reviewed this kind of setting and what I'm reviewing some of that here, we gave an exact definition of what this is. It's some function of the Archimedean parameters that can be written down explicitly if you know the Archimedean parameters. All right, that's a crucial thing in the subconvexity problem, which I'm going to review later. All right, so the problems, so while there's great progress in conjectures, the problems in which there's progress in by means of proof are firstly moments, and I'll put up a slide of the progress here. So we now have moment conjectures, which I'll schematically remind you, which you've seen enough of. There's the subconvexity, which I'm going to discuss. These are the problems in which we have complete proofs. There's progress. So this is what I meant by taking stock. And also, while I take stock, I'll tell you where I think the difficulties are. And the young guys can prove me wrong. Please prove me wrong. Or even old guys. But there I'll be much more jealous. Non-vanishing in families. And non-vanishing on the line one. As far as I know, these are the main areas of development. And so let me start with moments, and let me, before I put up what is known, remind you the kind of thing that the moment problem is concerned with. So we're dealing with any of these families here. A family will be examples that I give. In my previous lecture, I said we're close to giving a definition. I think we'll be able to give a definition before long, but right now it still is a collection of juicy examples, if you wish. It could just be one zeta function on the line a half. T is a parameter in a family. You have a family F of automorphic forms. All are of the same degree. All are of the same degree. So if they stand at L functions, they're all coming from cusp-forms on GLN for a fixed N. If they were not standard, if they were made through a row or through something like this, they would be all of the same degree. It is a conjecture that if you form a more fancy L function, like a high tensor power of a GL2 guy, that it should be a standard L function on a bigger group, or product of standard L functions. That's part of the big functoriality conjecture of Langlands. So really, if you understood everything about functoriality, and if you understood the Riemann hypothesis for standard L functions, you'd be home and dry. We'd be out of business, I think. You'd have to prove random matrix things on distributions, which might be harder. Is harder, in my opinion. So in a sense, it's technology, or the inability to understand high tensor powers, that forces us to look at some of these things which may be more primitive in the form of the standard L function, but we will have to capture them in the way they land in our hands. So we have a family of automorphic forms, all of the same degree. That's certainly one thing. And we'll, for each F in F, we have these L functions, and moments means we take the sum at L a half F to the power M. So this would be a moment for M greater than 1. We only take integer moments if you want to make progress. Sum over F, usually sum over the conductor about X. Dyadic sums are much better than non-dyadic sums, so there's no reason to sum up to x. Often you might sum near x, meaning dyadically between x and 2x, or something of that nature. And the random matrix conjectures say that once you've identified the symmetry type, GF, of the family, which we have recipes to compute what the symmetry type is in explicit terms, then there's a conjecture for these moments. These should be roughly asymptotic to the number of forms in question in the family with conductor about x times some polynomial of a degree which depends on the family with explicit coefficients. But I'll just say Pm of log of the conductor. That's the leading term. And usually when you get the full leading term, you actually, if you work hard, and it's a crucial point, you might even get a power saving. So if I say a moment is done, I have in mind that you actually get a power saving, if you don't mind. I'll emphasize when that is a issue. And sometimes we only get close, and then the power saving is not in sight. All right, so that's a conjecture, a completely general and beautiful conjecture, which I have right now given all the evidence, all the faith in, complete faith in that. But the question is, can you prove any of this? And I want to show you why proving these things is so powerful in applications. Though I won't show the applications, I'll just say it's powerful. So, the examples, of course, are the ones that are mentioned always immediately, the Riemann zeta function. Now, while it is embarrassing that we've never got up to the sixth moment, and this fourth moment was done a long time ago, that's m equals 2 and 4. By 4 here, I mean in the Riemann zeta function, if this is complex valued, I would usually take an even power. An even power means a number times its complex conjugate, if you don't mind. So the second and fourth moment are classical, Hardy, Littlewood, and Ingham. And in fact, the version, I believe, with the remainder, first version with the remainder, I'm not sure, but I think that's Estermann first. Because you have to deal with a certain off-diagonal term to get the remainder if you want to get a power saving. And it was Estermann who understood the use of Clostermann's method in this context. To me, it's the technique that's important. So I would like to say Estermann, but I may be wrong on that.
I think you're right.
What? I am wrong?
I think you're right.
I'm right, thank you. That's rare.
So one of his students.
What, sorry?
He's
one of his students. The truth is still the truth. The truth is still the truth. All right, when you sum up a family's d up to x, so there are only two moments known there. And what's interesting is as we get into more fancy families, we get further, and we have actually more, or many, unusual, more striking applications even. So the family of quadratic twists was mentioned by Sound this morning. In fact, Jutila computed the first two moments and Sound the third moment. And as Sound pointed out, the fourth moment is one of those things that's just out of reach and a very challenging technical problem. But higher moments here are sort of hopeless, and I want to describe why the certain approaches are difficult, or why I think many people are moving in certain directions, and I'll just tell you the difficulties I found anyway. A very important piece of work, which is not often cited, is due to Anton Good, who did the second moment of an automorphic form on the upper half plane. Holomorphic, he had very special tricks. Today we understand how to do all these things quite generally. He's just looking at automorphic form F on the upper half plane. Think of your favorite thing, like the Riemann-Jahn delta function. And in the T aspect, we're looking at the moments like you would for the Riemann zeta function, and he was able to do, I didn't write down what he did, sorry. He did m equals 2. He did the second moment. Sorry. The interesting thing is his proof actually has no arithmetic in it, and I want to emphasize this. Spectral theory is much more powerful in this context than arithmetic, believe it or not, and that's the message of my lecture. And hopefully spectral theory actually has the answer of everything in it eventually, but that's problematic. So, in the Q aspect, I don't know who did the first few moments, but certainly the third and fourth moment, as far as I know, were done by Michel Kowalski and Van der Kam a few years ago. So, that is, you're taking the family of, holomorphic forms of a fixed weight, maybe weight 2 if you wish, and you're averaging L1 half, the hardest case there that's discussed would be L1 half F to the power 4, summed over all guys, new forms if you like, maybe They probably took Q equals prime from my experience with them. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, they usually do that. Makes life much easier. So I'm being, maybe they haven't done the general case, I'm not sure. But anyway, Q equals prime is the beef. And they do the fourth power. And there's room even there with remainder, in the sense that I was talking about before. And this is already quite difficult. And I will discuss the methods in a minute. So we have four moments there. And has anyone checked that their lower order terms agree with the random matrix conjecture? Well, this is sort of shameful, because if you have a conjecture and you have a theorem and you haven't checked that they agree, that's naughty. But we have such confidence in these conjectures, and in actually, if they don't agree, I would put my money on the conjectures. That's happened to the guys at Utah, and we learned our lesson with counting curves. All right, so yesterday Ivich mentioned the same thing. In the eigenvalue aspect, one has that too. Ivich described the fourth moment yesterday. The first two moments, probably Kuznetsov, I'm not sure, but the lower moments are very easy. Fourth moment's already quite tricky. Now, there's a lot of progress in higher degree, but they still formed out of GL2. And this is the reason I introduced more general things. So in the Rankine-Selberg aspect, and I want to emphasize that each, as I go down this list, the new results actually morally contain the previous results, but not technically. And that's because if I take Rankine-Selberg FG, where G is an Eisenstein series, then the L function, this is a lovely fact of the world that many people have exploited, that the L function of F times G, where G is an Eisenstein series, actually factors nicely into a product of two L functions. And if that Eisenstein series is chosen carefully, you'll actually get L squared, and you would get back to a fourth moment back there. However, the fact that the Eisenstein series is not square integrable makes life that much more complicated, that actually to execute from here to there could be more complicated than actually doing the whole proof from the beginning. But morally, so if the world depended on it, this is a stronger result than all of the ones before, and as I go down, they contain all the ones before. So the Rankine-Selberg L functions, I was able to do subconvexity, which I'll explain requires doing this first. For M equals 1, 2, this is for holomorphic forms with weight varying. But in this, I emphasize G is fixed. And the same trio, MKV, Michel, Kowalski, and Vanekamp. Sometimes one of these is not on the three, but I view them as the young mafia who have all these sharp results. They do the Q aspect, the same theorem. So this is the first and second moment for something which is degree 4. Now I emphasize we are not allowing F and G to vary simultaneously. That is a crucial and difficult problem, an important one. It would solve many problems if you could deal with it, including the symmetric square case, which I'll maybe return to later. And then most recently, Bernstein and Reznikov have managed. Now, actually, when I explain the method, you'll see everything is spectral. And what I like very much in their work, though I haven't understood it completely, is that they take these L functions, and they actually, Bernstein always tells me, what is an L function? So he says, every time I see him, what is an L function? How did you normalize it? So to him, an L function doesn't have size, only has zeros. But finally, he managed to use some formula that I'll show you, which says that he's never going to look at an L function. And this result actually gets proved, Bernstein and Reznikov, by no use of Fourier coefficients. The coefficients in the Dirichlet series are not there. Once you're at that point, he feels comfortable. Most of us feel very uncomfortable. Nevertheless, they have done the following case. FG, phi lambda, so F and G are fixed. So it's again linear in one of the variables. So it doesn't capture some of the most interesting cases we're interested in. But it's linear. So these are fixed. That's varying. It's a degree 8 thing now. It's a degree 8 thing. And they obtain essentially that piece of information for M equals 1 only. But these numbers are non-negative, as you'll see. So a first moment's already got tremendous information on it towards bounding. And then two more, and that'll be more or less my summary of what's known about moments. I mean, I'm not doing the large sieve, the 1970s theorems, if you don't mind. Those are great, very important, but those are sort of classical. So here is one more family found by Conry and Ivanich maybe 4 or 5 years ago, for which they can do the third moment of the following. They're taking F in gamma naught Q, and they're twisting it by quadratic character chi Q. The quadratic character Q is square free here. The unique quadratic character with that discriminant fundamental chi Q. And they're taking automorphic forms which transform under gamma naught Q by that character. So that's the Nebentippers. They look at weight zero, they're cunning, I'll tell you why now, and they are able to do the third moment. And this is quite a difficult case, and unless something's changed, you don't have the asymptotics here. Is that correct?
Correct.
So this is a case where, when I said that you prove this, you can prove this in a number of levels. You could prove the right upper bound meaning to me n to the x to the nx to the 1 plus epsilon. Actually, one of the main interests in moments is, of course, the upper bound, because the moments imply Lindelof, and that's the most powerful statement that can come out of size of L functions as far as uniformity goes. So it's the upper bounds that in the end probably are more important than anything else and the hardest to get your hands at, and the things we can't make progress on. But I do emphasize getting the main term and a remainder because it's connected to subconvexity, as I'll explain in a second. Here they are obtaining just the upper bound, so they've already worked very hard, full use of the sums of the Lean, multidimensional exponential sums, and the upper bound is Q to the 1 plus epsilon. Now Lindelof, of course, would agree with that. They're getting the right upper bound over this family. They're roughly Q such forms. The spectral theory has a discrete part and a continuous part, and they live off the continuous part. This is a lovely thing to do. So they get actually naturally, as Ivich had in his formula, two terms, one coming from the continuous spectrum, one from the discrete spectrum. And hence they get, and this is a crucial point, it is quite remarkable that these functions, which L1/2f, which are non-negative if the Riemann hypothesis is true for that L function, are known to be non-negative without unconditionally. This is one of the remarkable things we know. The first signal of such a thing is due to Waltz-Berger. There are many developments since then about proving non-negativity. The most important result, or the most general result today, is due to Lapidus here and Rallis, who saw how to use the general theory of Eisenstein series to obtain this in all known cases and many more. So then if you use a non-negativity, you can say that this term is non-negative. You throw away most of the space, and then you get an upper bound for L1/2 chi Q. And while I am not going to talk about records, this is not all my I couldn't resist this one, which gives the first improvement on a bound of Burgess that I'll write down for Dirichlet characters. Subconvexity was known, but this 1/6, which is the natural thing that should come out of characters in GL1, is not known in the Q aspect, but this part is known. And it's part of the theme of the subject that I want to go higher dimensions, and this is an example of using higher dimensions to understand GL1. It may be desperate also, but here's a proof that something did come out at a technical level. It's very technical. Anyway, that's an interesting family. And another very tough family, at least for me, is one that Watson and I recently deal with. And that is the first moment where now everybody's varying. So here, phi t, the important thing is that I have three GL2 guys, mass forms, phi t and phi t are both the same. They're varying. Their eigenvalue is t squared plus a quarter. I'm going to sum over all the third guy, which is of size t, roughly, dyadically. This is not an exercise in trying to do moments. This was forced on us in trying to do another problem. We were able to get the right upper bound t to the 2 plus epsilon. I certainly cannot conceive of getting this at this point. But that was good enough to prove a sharp bound of the L4 norms of eigenfunctions. This was a key moment calculation, the first moment. And this is tough because the phis vary. All three are varying then. That's what's unusual. All three are varying, and the Bernstein-Resnikoff stuff allows only one to vary. And Bernstein-Resnikoff, I emphasize so far, is only in the case of the eigenvalue aspect, but it's crying out to be done in the conductor aspect. All right, so that's what we know about moments, and I want to say a few words about the techniques that go into this and why we can't do Lindelof simply by going to GLN. Because that is a dream of many people. let me go back to the blackboard and describe how the spectral theory is at the heart of all these results, spectral theory. After, well, let me explain the methods. So, the methods that involve approximate functional equations, well, that's standard, I don't talk about it. I want to get to the what is sort of the heart. So, one remark is this. If you want to do the fourth moment of zeta, you first take the sum, you square zeta, so you get this series. And then, the thing I want to remark here is that this thing is a GL2 object. If you take the ordinary Eisenstein series, EZS, sorry, it's just, I shouldn't overuse S, but anyway, take the Eisenstein series, let me define it, sum of y to the s over cz plus d to the 2s cd relatively prime. This is the continuous spectrum of the modular group, the Eisenstein series, of course, first introduced by Eisenstein. This is a modular function in Z, it's not holomorphic. Now, if you evaluate this at 1/2, I wrote a paper about evaluating that at 1/2, gave it to Solberg when I was a young man, and then ran back to his office 20 minutes later when I realized this function was zero, and I was proving amazing things about this function, about this function zero, and I said, could you give it back to me? I there's something I forgot. Just give me the copy. Okay, so it's not a serious problem. You take the derivative with respect to S, and s equal 1/2. Now you'll get a non-zero function. Let's call that h of z. It's not a cusp form. It's a modular form. It's a mass form with eigenvalue a quarter, but not a cusp form. And it's L function in the sense that I was defining before, even though before I only defined it for cusp forms. These things potentially are poles, is this function. So this is the connection, firstly, between zeta to the fourth and the upper half plane. This is the connection. If you look at Titchmarsh's book, he doesn't know about mass forms. He doesn't want to know about mass forms. These are some ugly partial differential equation thing. Well, actually, probably he'd never seen them anyway. So, though he worked in orthogonal expansions of in eigenfunctions quite a lot. So he actually doesn't like this. So he actually forms in the book e to the 2 pi inz. Inz. And tries to make a modular form out of that. Of course, that's not a modular form, but it has an approximate transformation, and he proceeds to argue there. And he gives a lower bound that I was mentioning this morning, which he does prove, by the way, this way, more or less. But for each, the constant depends on k in what I was talking about. Anyway, if you take zeta squared, you're now really facing the problem. Forget, so this is a license I'm taking here, that when you're not a cusp form, things are more difficult from some angles, but they are things that I think we'll always overcome. So the question is, can you do the mean square, say you want to do, can you do the mean square? I'm trying to explain the fourth power of zeta, or the mean square of an L function of an automorphic form on the upper half plane in the T aspect. Can you do this integral, this asymptotics for mean square for this problem of just the T aspect? Now, if you do, as Sound did, and Montgomery wrote this down as well, you write an approximate functional equation, you switch orders, you get diagonal, which is, of course, the answer here. It's interesting that in the higher powers, it's not the diagonal that is the answer. That's where random matrix theory enters conjecturally. But when you're going to prove something, you'll have off-diagonal. And to get a remainder term in this kind of asymptotics, you will be facing the following, the coefficients lambda fn, lambda fm, and you'll only be near the diagonal. N minus m equals h, where h is small, times some smooth function. N will be going up to like t, and this is just switching orders. One of our main tools is switching orders, let's be honest. Serre's description of analytic number theory, switch orders. That was, switch orders and be very, very clever. That's one I think is more accurate. Okay, you switch orders, and then you have to face this, and you have to get some cancellation of this. If this is d of n plus 1, for example, that would enter into your problem. But you could ask this more generally with these Fourier coefficients of a cusp form or an Eisenstein series. So that's a connection, and you need cancellation in the sum. And when I said Estimate did the fourth power, it is because he knew how to get cancellation in the sum. where H was some fixed small number, by using the circle method. In particular, he wrote his paper on these kind of things soon after Clostermann. It was Clostermann who enabled one to deal with four-variable quadratic forms, which is what's there in the simple case and what's secretly somehow there in the general case in the upper half plane. So there is an approach via the Clostermann or circle method. This Clostermann, I wouldn't call refinement. Clostermann's contribution is pretty major. Okay, so that's the way one did the fourth power with remainder even, not just the main term. And in general, this is what enters no matter which way you slice it. In every case that I'm talking about, except I don't understand the most recent case of Bernstein and Resnikoff that we haven't got to the bottom of yet. But in all other cases, the minute you try to do this by actually staring at the coefficients, these are the kind of sums you have to deal with. So these are the main sums. They go by shifted convolution. And the standard approach, and Hughes, I asked him which method he used. By now, one standard approach is a smoothed version of the Clostermann method. It took us, this community, a long time to realize smoothing buys you a lot. The smooth version of this, so it's technically much simpler, is called the delta method of Duke Friedland and Ivanich. They wrote so many papers on where this kept on coming up that they found a means of doing it. However, it's still based on Clostermann's dissection of the circle. However, Selberg, and many of you may know, pointed quite a while ago, in 1965, to a treatment of this kind of sum using spectral theory. What he pointed to there was very difficult to use, and Kuznetsov made it more explicit and useful, there's no question about that. But he pointed to some very simple ways of incorporating that into the spectrum, and for a long time, Good was able to exploit this in some special cases. Today we have a complete treatment of these kind of sums, which are dealt with spectrally. They avoid Clostermann sums, but they bring in the spectrum directly. I'm saying this new step, perhaps, of Resnikoff and Bernstein, has the feature of even avoiding the coefficients and going directly to the spectrum. It's the spectrum that gives cancellation in the sums, and the mass form spectrum, even if you're working with a holomorphic form. So there are two approaches. Let me just make this clear here. So one has to handle this convolution sum in all this and in all subconvexity if you look at the coefficients. So these are sums of the form lambda fn, lambda fm, if you're in over q, where you have nu 1n minus nu 2m equals h. So you have a linear relation like that, where if you're using amplification, which I'll turn to in a second, nu 1 and nu 2 are small. H might be big, in fact, in this kind of q aspect. H is usually big. But you have constraints like this, a linear constraint. And the variable is n. This forces m to solve that equation. And you're looking on the off-diagonal terms, meaning you're not looking where h is 0 or n equals m. And you want to see that the Fourier coefficients of modular forms cancel. The correlations sums, when you sum over a fixed f like that, cancel. And there are two methods. One, as I said, is the Clostermann delta, or the smooth version delta method, which Ivanich, Friedlander, and Duke found extremely useful and polished to the point where it's quite beautiful. And there's the spectral method. And the spectral method has turned out to be more powerful, at least in the number field. That's one of the insights that Piotrowski, Shapiro, and Cogdell and I have had. Is that if you go to a number field, the Clostermann refinement is not known. Clostermann spent many years trying to see how to divide up a torus the way he divided up a circle, and he couldn't see how to do it. And so the circle method a la Clostermann has been, since his time, a problem. But the spectral method, which is using much fancier machinery and eventually using Ramanujan-type conjectures, known results towards Ramanujan, is quite powerful. And so you have to treat this off-diagonal. All right, so that's a connection there. Then you say, wait a minute, if zeta squared comes from GL2, then zeta cubed must come from GL3. That's correct. So if you want to do the sixth power moment, you're supposed to mess around on GL3. Now, that's what many of us went there to do. Well, I've tried this for many, many years, and let me tell you at least one difficulty with the CAFE moment coming from GLK, is that when you try set up a family, you have to succeed in this off-diagonal analysis. You have to get in a ballpark in the first place, and every attempt of mine anyway in Piotrowski on GL3, in the end, is connected with the converse theorem. And this became very apparent when one goes to a number field. The advantage of going to a number field is, say you want to understand these ideas with 2x2 matrices over a number field, the mean square of a number field, the mean square for zeta, the Dedekind zeta function, is just as hard as if the number field's arbitrary degree, is just as hard as Lindelof, as the mean square, or the height power of zeta. And what we kept on finding is that you might want to get L S zeta to a power. So you might want zeta cubed, say. And when you build up a family which is naturally associated with this higher dimensional symmetric space, we could only prove some the mean values, not just for zeta, but depending on what the converse theorem philosophy would give us, and it's closely related, is zeta cubed, or these twisted by GL2 forms. In other words, that's why I introduced that. We would want to do a half plus IT, just the T aspect, but we found that maybe F is fixed, might correspond to zeta cubed. We'd have to, in the one case, at least twist by GL2 forms, a hybrid version where this depends on that. Then we could do the mean square of a GL3 form. But we could never get just T alone. Or if we use the fancier converse theorem, we could twist by Dirichlet characters here. And we understand all this quite well today. But it seems that we don't know how to get just a one-dimensional integral. And that makes sense because, after all, when you form the L function in Hecker's method in the upper plane, you integrate from 0 to infinity y to the s. So you have the Mellin transform along a line. And Plancherel, Parseval will tell you that the mean square is the mean square here, after you do appropriate killing of gamma factors, is the mean square of the automorphic form, and the refinements that come from equidistribution of this nature, which is to get the remainder term, are in the ballpark, even perhaps using ergodic theoretic methods, if I jump ahead a little bit there. But when you start with GL3 and try form an L function, you don't just integrate over one geodesic, you do a multiple integral first, and each time you integrate, and in all subconvexity or these kind of problems, something's oscillating quickly. Your first integral introduces cancellation, and if you ever want to see all the cancellation you introduced in order to do a mean square, you need to fatten up with other harmonics, if that makes any sense. Well, maybe all that makes sense is this dream is something we failed at. If you look at this seriously, you try to look at a number field. And if you look at a number field, you might say, all right, let me take Q square root minus 1. This I did in the 80s, trying to understand this. F is a same automorphic form. And I want to do the mean square. K is this number field. This integral would correspond to the 8th power of zeta, if you could execute it. And what I found is that the natural object was not just this, but because of this converse theorem that I say underlies this, and Booker's lecture this morning might give you a little bit of hope that maybe converse theorems really only need one twist. If that were really true, you would be home and dry.
Do you mean the fourth power of that?
Fourth power, yeah. Sorry. But if you twist by the unramified Grossmann characters here, this is the missing stuff. Let me write the Grossmann characters lambda to the m. It's generated by one guy in an imaginary quadratic field. M less than or equal to m1 m integral from 0 to t. So as long as these two are roughly equal. In fact, I only dealt with the case that they were equal. But today, I know how to deal with this more generally. But roughly, they have to be the same size. Then you could get the analog of, I don't know what you want to call it here, Ingham's result or estimate result. You do need an off-diagonal analysis. So it doesn't naturally come out with these guys, just one parameter. And by the way, when Vey wrote his converse paper, He did an Apoff plane, then he turned to a number field. This is his little book on Dirichlet series and modular forms, the Springer lecture notes. That book is entirely devoted to these Archimedean extra features that you have to add in these basic unramified Grossen characters in the statement of the converse theorem. They're naturally there. So I believe that the fact that we succeed in GL2 to do the fourth moment is connected with the converse theorem, and the natural thing in GL3 is something more complicated. Oh, wow. I'm going way too slowly. I was going to give a whole discussion of Motohashi's program. I'll leave it to you two and me, because I have something interesting there. Well, anybody is interested, I'll be happy to explain what I think is the problem there. Let me now just go to subconvexity, because that was the topic I wanted to cover. Luckily, subconvexity is very closely related to this sum and to moments. And let me just explain the philosophy in subconvexity, because this is the problem, which is a much more modest problem. It doesn't ask for the full Lindelof high moments. It says, do better than what first meets your face. And that is an approachable problem. Just do a little better. So let me remind you what it is. This is a beautiful problem with quite remarkable application. I didn't get into this. Ivanich, Duke Friedlander, my buddies have been working on this for years. But as I had more problems of mine being resolved just by this statement, I felt I better join the mad rush. And it is a remarkable thing for application. So we have a family F. You might think of all forms, you could make it all forms on GLN. And I want to estimate L1 half F. It could be a half plus IT. I would just build that in by twisting by what I call a quasi-character. So I want to estimate L1 half F. Let me not say why exactly first. Let me tell you what's obvious and what's not obvious. So the function's analytic. It's got a functional equation. And you can imagine that to estimate that, the conductor enters that number in the functional equation, and it enters. And not only does the conductor enter, but so does the Archimedean factors, the ratio. So the whole analytic conductor enters very naturally in a trivial effort to estimate this by convexity. But you cannot estimate what Sam said today. I don't know how to estimate an L function in the region of convergence unless I know something about those root numbers. Remember when I said the local L function was a product with those alphas? There's a beautiful general conjecture of Ramanujan, a generalization of a conjecture of Ramanujan, which says all those numbers are modulus 1. We don't know that, and without knowing that, we can't estimate the L function, perhaps, to the right of 1, something that's supposed to be trivial. So how am I going to get to start using convexity if I'm in trouble on the line 17? In a remarkable paper, generalizing a GL2 argument of Ivanich, Molteni, and he will lecture on it later this week, so I'll say Molteni, Ivanich, showed that you can, using Rankin-Selberg and an iterative procedure which is quite subtle, actually get the right bound up to the line 1 and even on the line 1/2, the trivial bound. Excuse me, I just call it the standard bound. It's not a trivial result. So when you know Ramanujan, this is trivial. That the L1/2 is the conductor, the analytic conductor, which is some explicit piece of the ramified part and the unramified part. This is the convexity bound. And that is known now. That's a remarkable thing. So that's the convexity bound. And the subconvexity problem . So remember, Lindelof, which follows from Riemann, is the statement that this is less than the conductor to the epsilon. The easy bound is this, if you know Ramanujan, and it's known anyway. And the subconvexity problem is to make the same estimate, but for find, or exhibit a delta positive, I don't care how small, such at the bound on the right, that you have a quarter minus delta in place of that. Here, epsilon's arbitrarily small. Here, delta is supposed to be an explicit thing. So you'll see in all statements of subconvexity some small fixed fraction. We don't really care what that fraction is. If we were really eager, we would try to prove Lindelof. That seems very difficult. But it turns out that many problems succumb just to that bound. These include the Andre Oort conjectures in many cases. They are mostly equidistribution problems. They include many problems with, in the most subtle aspects of quadratic forms, representations of integers. They also include problems in quantum unique ergodicity equidistribution of eigenfunctions. Many, many different things, and I'm sure the list of problems which are just resolved by subconvexity will grow as people find more and more identities relating periods and special values of L functions. So what do we know about that? I still have 5 minutes. And then let me just point out one very important technique called amplification and when it is needed. It's only needed in one kind of instance. So for zeta, this is due to Hermann Weyl's subconvexity. He didn't prove it, I know, but his methods gave it. And Burgess, for Dirichlet characters, this he gave the bound of q to the 3/16. This is the bound that Connery and Ivanich improved on for quadratic characters after many, many years. So, the subconvexity, I just am talking about who did subconvexity, not world records. Good, again, using non-arithmetic methods, because that shifted convolution thing that I discussed there, even in Good's work, does not at all depend on arithmetic. It comes from a spectral analysis of the Laplacian, amazingly. And the remarkable thing is one can prove a subconvex estimate for an L function for a non-arithmetic group. So if you think I'm just saying word non-arithmetic, you could actually take a Hecker triangle group, something Hecker loved, which is non-arithmetic. So instead of having pi over 3 in the corner, you would have pi over 5. Now all the L functions you form don't have Euler products or anything like that, but they do have the Dirichlet series and functional equations. Hecker was quite fascinated with this, not quite knowing what they mean. But they are interesting to test ideas. And for those, you can prove subconvexity, even though we have no idea what the coefficients of a holomorphic form they are in any sense of the word, but the subconvexity comes from this shifted convolution, so you can't use circle methods or anything like that. So Good's method is really non-arithmetic, and all right, in a series of 9 papers over how many years? Many, many years. Duke, Friedland, and Ivanich over 12 years have really given us GL2 over Q, only over the rationals, but that's plenty good in all aspects. The first aspects were Good and Murmann. They gave subconvexity in every other aspect. And I want to mention one technique they introduced, which Friedland and Ivanich introduced, but used nicely in this context. And then we now know many, I'm running out of time, so we know it in Rankin-Selberg, in the aspect where one is fixed. These all contain the previous morally, as I explained. And we know, now Bernstein and Resnikoff have obtained the first triple product one, no coefficient, so use the spectrum is brought in. Have time to explain. So I want to spend 4 minutes, which is all I have left. I don't have any time left. But let me just explain amplification, not to you, but to... When do you need amplification? What is this word that is always buzzed around? So it's a lovely idea, and it's only needed in the case where you are stuck desperately. And often, with all due respect, these fellows have amplified long before they thought. So there are many. There are at least 2 papers where, had they thought first, they would have avoided amplification and made their results unconditional, as they did anyway, but in a later paper. So the thing about subconvexity is it's not a science, it's an art. And that being an art, it's not easy. It will become a science, I hope. Suppose I want to estimate L1/2f. In this philosophy, what you do is you think of moments, and you maybe take power 2 or 4, or maybe 1 if these are known to be positive in the family, and I sum over f in f, and the other conductor might be some size, x. And before you start, you have to get yourself in a favorable position as follows. You want to be able to say the following. If I sum a positive set of quantities, this should be, the leading term was not so important in their early works, I'm talking, say, about Duke, Friedland, and Ivanich, because the leading term, we weren't comparing with random matrix theory at the time. So, of course, you will have the number here, of forms, roughly. And then Lindelof, this is supposed to be x to the epsilon, so let's throw a 1 plus epsilon. You would expect that upper bound. Subconvexity is only about estimating something better than the trivial bound. All right, so suppose I can establish this by averaging over a family. The same techniques which you use to average over a family to get the moments. Well, this is a moment calculation, but I only need the upper bound here. And suppose I'm in a lucky situation that I can actually get the right upper bound. But there's a tremendous tension here that I want both to get the right upper bound and I want my family to be small. Because what I want to do at this point is something very crude. If these are non-negative, I'll get that L1 half F is less than or equal to the norm with the number 1 over M plus X1. And if I'm lucky enough, the number of terms that I'm averaging over to the 1 over M is better than the convexity bound, and that will be a means of getting a subconvex estimate. That's the technique of trying to use moments to get a subconvex estimate. If you can do M arbitrarily large, this is how Lindelof follows from the powers trivially. But we only can do these things in special families, in special ranges. That's what we are able to do at this point, and we are only asked to do better than the trivial bound. So the first thing you have to do, and this is the art, is to deform F into a family, often not the family that's sitting in front of your face. So sometimes you look in, this is obviously the family, but sometimes you actually might, if it's a Rankine-Selberg, you might not move that guy, you might move another guy. And that's where the art comes in, and we don't understand this completely. But anyway, you deform F in a family, so you really want this estimate for a given F naught, because you want to prove it for all Fs. So you introduce a family which contains F naught as a typical member with roughly the same conductor, and you do this. Now, in all cases of success, you get to this position, you say, I get back the trivial estimate immediately, and you say, that's when you say, I'm close. I'm close, I just need one little bit extra. If I could raise that to a slightly bigger power, but m's come in integers, so if you put 2m here, you find you can't execute it anymore. So, if you're doing a problem of analysis like the Riemann zeta function or mass forms or quantum chaos type problems, you don't have an integer variable. You have a continuous variable, a holomorphic forms of weight k. You usually land up weight averaging k is fixed and then k, little k goes between capital K and 2k. Or in the mass form, there's a range. All you do then is you just shorten this range if there's an analytic parameter. You shorten here. Now, this analysis was supposed to already just come from the diagonal. The minute you shorten, you face the off diagonal. I don't say you always get straight to this, but after enough dualizing, that's the workhorse of everything. So in all these proofs, you shorten, you win, you don't need amplification. So to do the fourth power, to do subconvexity for zeta this way, or there's no need for amplification. But there are situations in which you don't see how to shorten the set anymore without some new ideas. So for example, maybe you're looking at L1 half F to the power 4, sum over F level Q, GL2. This is an example of the Ivan Echtuk-Prienlander series of papers. So you're looking at this fourth power, and you prove this is less than Q to the 1 plus epsilon, just by diagonal analysis, large shift type inequalities. And now you're in the ballpark. But how are you going to make less Fs here than already you're facing your there's no analysis, there's no error. Q is a number, and you already got Q of these forms there. And this, and only here, that I know of, is amplification needed. You introduce, as Sound was saying a little bit this morning, you introduce I'll just stop after saying a couple of words here. You take a series. So this, of course, is reminiscent of many things before, but it was them who realized this is a powerful tool. AFM, lambda FM, squared. Now, the fact that you can do the moment with some remainder means you faced certain off diagonals is the same, also equivalent, more or less morally, and it's a fact, to being able to take a short sum here where this capital M, think of as a small power of Q. So what you do is you put in this factor, which is MF, assume the AMs are less than or equal to 1 in absolute value, and then you, as a bilinear form in A, you make an estimate here, which using AM less than or equal to 1 gives you the expected upper bound that you would expect if you had a little bit of room here. So in fact, when you finish, you get here not M squared, but M. You prove this for M, arbitrary small, but fixed small power of Q. This is a general bilinear inequality. Now you say, let me choose the AMs to amplify the guy I want to estimate. That's where the name comes from. So you choose AM to be lambda F naught M bar. And then this is going to be morally size M squared, and then I get Q to the 1 plus epsilon over M, rather, and I win a small exponent. There's one difficulty here, and just to answer Ivich and these and Jutila, is when Ivanich was first doing this on one problem, which later should not be done by amplification, as I was saying, he ran into a weird difficulty. If I make AM lambda F naught, so I'll have lambda F naught M bar, and this will be lambda F naught M squared, and I'm summing M up to M, I want that to be big. But maybe, I don't know Riemann here, maybe this form F naught is one of those Ziegel zero kind of beasts, and this particular F naught I want to estimate, all its first coefficients are zero, except for the first. Which it can't be. Nothing's to stop that. So he ran into trouble, and he, in his paper, his first paper of subconvexity that you know on mass forms, he it was conditional. He didn't feel this was a serious issue, but then in a paper he and I wrote, doing some other amplification, was fixed up trivially. A lambda FM can be small at P, but then it's not small at P squared from a Hecker relation, so you always win from this. So your exponent will be weaker. The exponent was not important. I have a lot more to say, but I'll stop.
You say the problem is with the converse theorem. The joy, the GL3 over 2 and GL2, converse theorem is the same thing.
GL2 over Q, idyllically it looks the same. Okay, that's a very good question. GL2 over Q, the way it is formulated modern idyllically by Winnie Lee Vey, by Winnie Lee and Petetsky and all, is you twist by all GL1. And the remarkable thing is the converse theorem in GL3, this is a remarkable insight of Mitetsky Shapiro, I think, that you still need to only twist what?
And Kangdell.
You still need to twist. This is Mitetsky Shapiro when he was on the ship from the Soviet Union to Maryland. I know exactly when he did. He understood a remarkable thing. The natural thing would you have to twist GL3 by GL2, but he understood you only have to twist by GL1. Now, in the upper plane case, you only have to twist by finitely many characters. That's the way they formulated. Booker explained those. You only have to twist in certain cases by none, actually, except a trivial character, which is quite remarkable. But in GL3, there is no finite version. And that's the problem. And the real reason was explained by Schmidt and S. Diemler in a recent paper where they written a Voronoi summation for GL3. I was discussing that yesterday. And it clarifies this point. So in fact, what you're using are additive twists, and then you need all additive twists, and then all the Dirichlet characters give you all multiplicative. So a possible type identity. Now, this was our hope for the sixth moment. Unfortunately, I don't believe there's a finite version. I mean, these are meta theorems. I don't believe there's a finite converse theorem in GL3 where you don't twist by anybody. If there were, then you absolutely would. Finite we can handle.